Money, money, I want more money.
True bear markets are like water torture. They just drip, 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 and they just drive you insane.
Need a little help understanding the current investment environment? Yeah, whereas a correction is more of like a sharp punch to the face.
Correct.
Or something. We'll take you to the corner of Pennsylvania Avenue and Wall Street. Yeah, there you go. Buy high, sell low is my motto on all of these things. Search for the Politico Money Podcast wherever you listen with me, Ben White.
Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Devere.
Oh, we're on the record, so I have
we
to
are
be
on
very,
the record.
We have to be very careful.
That's okay.
Here.
The microphone's in your face.
It is. Yeah, I mean, I think there were times where I rebelled against sort of the label,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it shaped me.
The
a
label
little.
Of you're the mayor's son.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, even today, you know, I don't like labels. I don't like partisan labels. I hate, you know, the idea that you can pigeonhole somebody or put them in a box and that all of a sudden defines who they are. I think we're...
That's very millennial of you.
Probably. I think we're just so much more complicated than that.
Today's guest, Miami Mayor Francis Suarez. Suarez was elected last year. He's 40, part of the next generation of political leadership in this country, and the youngest Latino in office in that prominent a position. His father, who is also mayor, is Cuban, born in Cuba. He's a registered Republican, but elected in a nonpartisan election. He did not vote for Trump, he told me, but he said he's open to voting for him in the next election. Maybe. He's in charge of a city where years ago they diluted the power from the mayor's office, and he's fighting to get it back. He's in the middle of one of the most important presidential and non-presidential swing states. Mar-a-Lago isn't far. So, a lot to discuss, and that's why I was glad we were able to sit down and spend the time, especially with Florida in the middle of intense races for governor and Senate going on right now, and Suarez trying to find his way through. Remember to subscribe, rate us, leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, or however you're listening. Tell a friend, tell a coworker, tell everyone you know, and email me your thoughts at isaac@politico.com. That's isaac@politico.com. And follow me on Twitter at Isaac Devere. So much more to come. And now, my conversation with Francis Suarez. Yeah, so you're a Generation Xer,
yes,
the end of it.
Correct.
And what does that do for you as the end of a Generation Xer, but wanting to see yourself as a millennial almost?
Well, it's interesting. I actually think of myself as a sort of a next generation elected official because my emergence as mayor sort of was at the tail end of my dad's generation.
Right.
Which began, interestingly, when he was a little younger than I am. He was 36 years old when he was mayor. And I jokingly tell him that he looked like he was 40, and I, who am 40, looked like I was 36. So, like, if I'm 36. So we have a laugh about that. But what's interesting is that he was first of his generation mayor.
Yeah.
First Cuban mayor, which was interesting.
Born in Cuba.
Second Latin mayor, because his predecessor was from Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. Mayor Ferre. But it was an interesting turning point. They're both interesting inflection and turning points for the city. One, you know, this emergence of immigrant Latin, Puerto Rican, Cuban influence in the city. And then the sons of those people, essentially,
right,
which were born in Miami. I mean, I'm the first, as far as we know, the first Miami-born mayor of Miami in 121-year history of the city. It's crazy. So nobody's been able to debunk that yet. Well, it actually makes sense if you think about it because if you think about the city, it's relatively young. I started going back, and how I came to this conclusion, I started going back and I said, well, if my dad was mayor of Miami and he was Cuban born, 1985, so you go back before that, Maurice was there for 12 years. So you go back to 1973, he was born in Puerto Rico. And you start going back and back and you say, wait a second, this could actually happen. And then when you start thinking about it from the other side, from 1897 or 96, when the city was created, you start thinking, well, to be mayor, you have to be, what, 25, 30 years old at least, right? So that puts you into the 1930s.
Yeah.
So you start compressing both sides of it, and we literally have not been able to find someone that was born in the city.
There's only so many mayors, right?
There's 33 mayors,
right.
We think, and I think I'm the first Miami-born mayor, which is interesting because that is, again, it's another inflection point for the city where the city is you know, able to nurture its own talent.
Yeah. And like a real place in the American landscape, right? Absolutely. Not just like some place where people go for vacation or whatever.
Right. Or
like
retirement.
That's,
or
that's like with Florida overall.
Or retirement, right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
No doubt. And I think that that is a, again, I think that is an interesting part of our story because it really influences the future of our story.
Yeah.
Right? I think the future of our story is that we used to be 20 years ago when I was 20, coming out of college, an intellectual talent exporter. You know, you would you know, go to high school down here. If you get good grades, you'd go up north to school and then you would stay up north. You'd stay in Boston or New York or DC or you'd go to the Middle East or you'd go somewhere else. Now, what we're seeing is that millennials, of which I am not one by a few years, are staying in Miami by and large. People in my generation, Generation Xers, 38 to 45 year olds, are either coming back or are staying. And then, of course, for a variety of reasons, we're attracting a lot of wealth, like hyper wealthy people.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of it from Latin America, South America, right?
I think it's really from everywhere. We're getting them really from everywhere. And the reason why we're getting them from the U.S. Because of the tax law. Mm-hmm. States like Texas and Florida are benefiting from a new tax law that does not allow state income taxes to be deducted from federal income taxes. So you have a flight capital based on that. If you think about the New York Miami comparison, New York is the weather's colder, the cost of living is higher, the city's denser, and now on top of all that, you've got to pay an extra 10-13% in income taxes because you don't deduct your state taxes. So
I mean, I grew up in New York, and Miami was again for vacation.
Right. And I think, but I think now people are doing that analysis and there's, you know, sort of the way I did it and they're saying, wait a second, we got to really take a hard look at Miami because the economic ecosystem in the city is changing dramatically. The Kauffman Foundation ranked us number one in startups in the nation. Now we're trying to get, we're sort of trying to graduate from being a startup capital to being a place where you can scale up, which is, of course, a very big exponential difference.
What's it like? You were 8 years old when your father was elected?
Yeah, 1985,
What's it like growing up with a father as mayor?
It's wild. It's a wild experience, but it certainly...
It's wild how?
It's wild because it's not usual. I mean, I just as an example, you know, when I was in classes, oftentimes there'd be a police officer standing outside of my classroom. That's not normal. Not a normal way to grow up. Mm-hmm. Your identity was derivative. It wasn't like you're Francis Suarez. It was you're the mayor's son.
Right.
So, you know, it casts a bit of a shadow. You know, my dad was someone who had a great story. You know, he's the ninth of 14 kids, came to this country with nothing at 12 years old, studied in high school, got a full scholarship to Villanova University, presidential scholarship, graduated summa cum laude, mechanical engineering, and then got two graduate degrees from Harvard and came down to Miami.
It's a real slouch.
Yeah, he's a slacker. And then he was the first Cuban mayor ever in the history of Miami. So he certainly was someone that... had accomplished a great deal professionally, academically, politically, and being his son was something that, but for him being such a good father, and he really emphasized being a good father or being a good everything else, it might have been much more difficult for me.
And you're how old when he's done being mayor?
I was 16. Those teenage years.
So you had cop following you around when you were a teenager?
Well, we had dignitary protection when, particularly if there was a credible threat on the mayor. My dad was very outspoken against the Colombian drug lords, and that did not
annoy him. Some threats.
That would create some threats. And so in that time, which was in the mid-80s and the early 90s, and so he certainly there was one threat that they had put a sicario in a container to kill the governor of the state of Florida and the mayor of the city of Miami. So our internal police or SIS, Special Investigation Services, Dignitary Protection in the city of Miami take those things very seriously.
Do you find yourself rebelling against him then when you're that age or beyond that, right?
Oh, we're on the record, so
we
have to be very careful.
That's okay. Here. The microphone's in your face.
It is. I think there were times where I rebelled against sort of the label. Mm-hmm. You know, and it shaped me.
The label of you're the mayor's son.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, even today, you know, I don't like labels. I don't like partisan labels. I hate, you know, the idea that you can pigeonhole somebody or put them in a box and that mm-hmm. all of a sudden defines who they are. I think we're.
That's very millennial of you.
Probably. I think we're just so much more complicated than that. And I think that we should embrace that complexity and that diversity of thought. And I think we should stop. I think it's a big problem that we have in politics, by the way, nationally. We should stop trying to pigeonhole each other and put each other in neat little boxes when everything that I know about people is not neat, but in a good way. You know what I mean? I always say that you don't know someone until you know their story. I just gave you a little bit about my dad's story and my own story. And I think it should inform people about me and about him. But I think we should strive to know people's stories rather than say, hey, the easy way out is to put them in this little box and then they must think this way about all these other things.
But do you get to a point where you think, like, I don't want to have anything to do with politics?
Absolutely.
Like, yes. So how long does that last?
my late 20s? No. it lasted a long time. You know, it's interesting.
Was it because you were pushing back against doing what your father did, or was it because of the experience you saw him have?
I think it was a little bit of both. Yeah. I think it was a little bit of both. I think, you know, I saw a person who, on my side of the ledger, I mean, without the cameras, without the microphones, was someone who was not only a great father, but lived and breathed his service. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in even the most minute things. You know, he was ethical to a fault, mm-hmm. In everything that he did and represented to me, in my presence. And so he lived the responsibility of being mayor. And even when he wasn't mayor, before and after, he lived it, in the way that he lived his life. He felt like he had to live, I think he felt that he was expected to be and should be at a higher standard. And I got to see that very, very close up. So when somebody or if somebody would criticize him, it did not really jive with what I knew mm-hmm. of him. And so it was hard to see and hard to watch. As you get older, you realize criticism is kind of a part of life.
Yeah, and certainly a part of politics.
It's certainly a part of, it's a huge part of politics.
That's and my job.
Well, and in a internet-based world and in a blogosphere world, mm-hmm. it becomes an even greater part, and it's one that you have to accept, you know, come to terms with, and to some extent be comfortable with if you want to do this.
And now you're mayor and your father is a commissioner.
Yes.
And the commissioners have a lot of power in Miami-Dade. Right?
Okay.
They, you say they so?
I think no. They would argue that they do.
Is that tricky?
No, I don't think it is at all. It's actually wonderful. It's actually very helpful. I mean, I can pick up the phone and call him. We give each other advice.
Well, you could pick up the phone and call any of the commissioners, I would assume, right?
I could pick up the phone and call him.
The mayor.
Actually, all 13 of them supported me in my campaign for mayor. Some sooner than others. But,
where is he on that list?
He was up there. He was up there. I got some funny stories about that stuff when I ran for commissioner the first time, but he's a trip. But he, no, it's a wonderful relationship. I think it's inures to the public's benefit that I have a good relationship with all county commissioners, like you said. And, you know, we're not in this business. We shouldn't be in this business to make enemies. You're in this business to build bridges so that you can serve better and more effectively.
I think one thing that I remember learning years ago about Miami and it surprised me is how dispersed power is. And the mayor's office is not a strong mayor's office. And that's something you want to do something about.
Yeah.
We are in a moment of rethinking a lot about politics and government and how it works. And there are people who want to see power dispersed more. And your argument would be it doesn't work.
Yeah, my argument is not necessarily based on sort of that macro argument. My argument is more focused. It's more based on best practices that cities are functioning under and experiences under the current system of government. So as the son of a mayor and someone who...
what can't you do that you want to do?
Well,
as mayor,
there's not much you can do as mayor that you want to do. In other words, the current structure only gives a mayor four powers, discrete powers, essentially. They're all derivative of some commission involvement.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you get to name the manager.
Mm-hmm.
So you go through this whole
process.
The manager
who's in charge of all the money.
Who's in charge of everything.
Right.
I mean, basically, who's the CEO of the company.
Right. So you name the manager, but the manager doesn't have to listen to you once
exactly.
The manager's been named.
And it's worse than that. If you tell the manager what to do, you can be removed from office and you can be charged with a third degree misdemeanor. So, I mean, it's insane that you go through this whole process of an election for 2 years. You gain the people's confidence, presumably. And
well, if you win.
If you win. And I won by 86%. And so you presume that the people have chosen you to lead their city. And then they come see you and, I really can't do that for you. And I can't tell the guy that I chose, who, by the way, I have to choose a guy now or a woman, or I have to choose a person subsequent to my election to run the city. Why not me? You chose me. And that person is not accountable to the people because they weren't elected by the people. They're not electable by the people and they're not recallable or anything. There's no democratic mechanism to, there's a political mechanism to change the person, but not a democratic mechanism. So that was one of the first problems. The second problem is that when you look at the history of the system of government, since its inception in 1997, you see that, let's put aside the philosophy of government. Let's look at the history of it. We've had 15 managers in 21 years. 15 managers. And I sort of jokingly say that.
And many fewer mayors than that.
Oh, yeah. We've had
four.
Like that.
Yeah.
So there's a stability issue there. And I jokingly say that we've had almost more managers than the Dolphins have had quarterbacks since Dan Marino. Dolphins have had 18. We've had 15.
That's a good Florida joke. That's
very close. Yeah, exactly. The Florida, the Miamians would get it. Not too much success, unfortunately. Hopefully, we'll have some success this year. There's eternal optimism in all of us. But so the stability, you know, if you look at the history, it has not been a stable system of government.
But that's the thing that ends up happening is power always goes somewhere. Right?
Correct.
And I remember years ago when I used to cover politics in New York, there's a guy who was the district attorney in Manhattan, Bob Morgenthau, legendary guy. He's like 98 years old, still around. But he was running for another term at 87 or something like that. And I said, well, doesn't it, you have to run again? Like, do you think like maybe there should be appointments for these jobs? And it's a district attorney and that legal stuff. And he said, you know, I would rather trust the people
absolutely.
Than one person. There's accountability that way, which, you know, he's a politician running for office, and it's, I guess,
sure.
what you say at that point. But it does, even when you take the power and move it away from the people who had it, someone else gets it, and that's what happened here.
Yeah, and it's a problem because the person that gets it is not accountable. It's not selected
yeah.
by the people. It's not accountable to the people. Can't be removed by the people.
Yeah.
And so to me, it's a little bit anti-democratic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the third thing is that when you look at the major cities in Florida and across the U.S., they all have strong mayors. In other words, in Florida, I've visited with all the mayors, Mayor of Orlando, Buddy Dyer, Mayor of Tampa, Bob Buckhorn, Mayor of Jacksonville, Lenny Curry, by the way, different from different parties. And then you look at the 25 top cities in the U.S., 70% of them have strong mayors. And the other problem that this system of government has is that it's very... you know, the legislative powers and the administrative powers are not segregated. I mean, I think that you shouldn't have a situation where the mayor selects a person that's got to be ratified by the commission. The commission can fire that person,
yeah.
irrespective of how the mayor feels about them, or the mayor can fire them and the commission can reinstate them. So imagine a system of government, and by the way, it's happened, so in Miami. So imagine a situation where you're the mayor, you were elected mayor, by the way, the only citywide elected official, because the commissioners are district elected through areas, and you fire your manager, say, it's not working out, you know, move on. And the commission says, no, we like this person. So we're going to force you to work with someone that we like that you don't like. I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
All right. You don't like labels. You were elected in a nonpartisan election, but
yes.
you are a Republican.
Yes.
Yes. You are also a Latino. You're proud of that.
Yes. Cuban.
Yes. What is it like at this moment to have both of those things be true in our greater political situation?
You know, it's actually interesting because, number one, most of the work that I do, I'd say it doesn't touch a large part of the work that I do. I would say 95, 96, 97% of what I do.
Sure, but it's you as a person, not like...
Well, let me finish the answer. So the 3% that it does touch, I think it's actually favorable. And I'll tell you why. It's so unusual that it's favorable. In other words, people, again, because people like to categorize and box and all those things, I become sort of a little bit of a unicorn, you know? And so that is interesting, intriguing to people. But for me, again, that's really more in their world, in their in their baskets of life. In my world, what I focus on is, I know it sounds cliche-ish, but just solving problems.
Sure.
And I definitely make it a concerted effort not to fall into those paradigms because it doesn't really help me. It doesn't really solve, it doesn't get me further, you know, closer to the goal. We're talking about county commissioners supporting me for mayor. They're all from three different parties. I ran for mayor and I had the Speaker of the Florida House supporting me, and I had the Minority Leader of the Florida Senate and incoming Minority Leader of the Florida House supporting me. So
I'd say I end up with 86% of the vote, I guess.
Well, I'm proud of that, you know, and I think, I think they can all call me and I can call them.
But you,
yeah,
Francis Suarez,
yes,
Republican, who is a Latino Cuban. Has it been a challenging moment for that to be true?
Not at all. I mean, not really.
Do you agree with what President Trump has been doing on the various issues that touch the Latino community?
Well, you know, I
don't want to talk about like the range of that because sure. The Cuban stuff is important on this also.
Sure. You know, I mean, I think, like you said, you know, I think there are some things that you agree on, some things you don't agree on. I'm very pro-immigration, having been an immigrant myself from an immigrant family. So I don't really understand sometimes a national conversation on immigration. I think somebody said it very ably here at the press conference that everyone in the United States, with the exception of Native Americans, are immigrants. Mm-hmm. So what are we talking about? You know,
So what's happened here? I mean, and you're not only, I'm the one who lives in Washington, I guess, right?
I think part of the problem is a Washingtonian approach to all of this, you know, which is...
Donald Trump's not from Washington. I mean, he lives there now, but...
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, I presume most presidents are not from Washington.
Sure.
So...
But he is, I mean, his whole thing is that he's the outsider,
it's
right?
The Washingtonian approach where it's a false... dichotomy, where you're either this or you're that.
Right.
There are many of the problems I think would be better served and better resolved if we stopped looking at it from that lens.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like immigration, beyond the partisan part of it, you're, in addition to your own background, you're the mayor of a city that is dependent on immigration, powered by immigrants all the time.
By the way, my dad is an independent. At one point, he was a Democrat. He's been in all three different parties at one point or another in his career. So it's not unusual. It's just a reflection, potentially.
Because there seem to be larger trends of Latinos moving away from the Republican Party now. That's why I was, and especially younger Latinos.
I would say that trend has been there for a long time. You know,
do you understand
for decades?
That?
Sure. And as a mayor, I can tell you that there are a lot of issues. If you were to classify the issue or pigeonhole the issue, which I hate doing, but if you were to do it, you would say that my agenda has been very liberal. You know what I mean? Affordable housing, gun violence and things of that nature.
You don't think of it as liberal. You think of it as doing what needs to be done.
I think of it as solving the problem. Yeah. I think of it as taking a pragmatic approach to getting things done. And I don't care, to be honest with you, whether someone thinks it is.
But
or
then
not.
Why are you still a Republican? If you feel like you're pursuing a liberal agenda.
You know, I don't think about it much, to be honest with you. I don't, you know.
You registered, and that was a long time ago.
I registered when I was 18 years old. I don't think about it a lot. I don't talk about it a lot. I do get asked a question every once in a while.
Well, this is part of the reason why I want to talk
to my friends from the Democratic Party.
But part of the reason I want to talk to you is because you are one of the younger Latino leaders in the country at this point, right? And whether you're Republican, Democrat, whatever, that in itself, it's an interesting moment for Latinos all across the country. For Latino Republicans, it seems like it's a challenging moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're definitely not the rule.
Yeah,
we're the exception, I would say. And I think, but there are a lot of conscientious Latin Republicans, Cuban Republicans, mm-hmm. like Carlos Corbello,
sure.
who's a you know congressman who I think takes a very principled positions
who's
on a variety of
around
issues.
Around your age, right?
He's about my age, a little younger than I am.
Yeah, a little younger.
But we grew
up
together. Yep. We're friends. You know, but there's a lot of people that I think that fall into that category where they don't necessarily approach issues on a partisan basis. They try to approach issues on a common sense basis.
Yeah. Although he's facing a tough re-election campaign, right? Because
that's the
because
nature of
what,
partisan America.
Right. Like what ends up happening then is people say, okay, well, I got it.
Yeah. And I think that's a flaw in our system, frankly. Yeah. Honestly, I think a guy like that who has, who's so smart, who's worked so hard, who's so well spoken in both languages, so articulate, and has such a good sense of where this country is and should be, mm-hmm. shouldn't have a tough re-election.
Yeah.
The fact that he has a tough re-election probably has to do with that partisan.
Yeah, no,
it's
the idea that like it's hard to be a Republican representing a district like his, which is in South Florida, right, and is where a lot of Latinos, a lot of other people have been moving away from the Republican Party.
Well, I'm not so sure that they were ever there, but
well. It was an easier race for him to run before.
Well, but that's different. That's for different reasons. That's more turnout based than that is actually, you know, movement, I think, of parties. There are some redistricting that happened. But what is fascinating about Florida generally is that they call it a purple state.
Mm-hmm.
And it's purple because every 2 years
it's not a purple state. It's a red state on the off years and a blue state usually in the presidential years. Of course,
but
Trump
what do you
won
get
it
when
less.
You combine
yes
red
but
and
it's
blue.
Like it's not there are states that are purple right that it but Florida just goes bounces back and
but
forth.
You know but even Trump winning Florida, I mean, it wasn't a large margin, it was a few percentage points, right? So it could have gone theoretically either
with
way
massive turnout against him in your
South
neck
Florida,
of the woods
in South Florida
and
right.
then massive turnout for him
up
on
north
the, right.
in the I-4 corridor.
No,
I agree. I mean, and I think that's the dynamic of Florida. What's interesting are different phenomena, economic phenomena. Like, for example, somebody was telling me this the other day, a gubernatorial candidate whose name will remain nameless was telling me that, and I'm sure you can figure out what party it's from, is that, you know, somebody was telling me about, we're talking about the federal tax law. And said, you know, the federal tax law is pushing a lot of people to Florida and Texas because, you know, as we were saying at the beginning of the show, you know, you can no longer deduct your income, you know, state income taxes. And I think the Republicans probably try to do it as a way of punishing, you know, states that have state income tax. But the effect of it is that they're driving people to states like Florida and Texas, and they're making them bluer.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll have an interesting political, you know, consequence potentially going forward, which I don't know was intended by those who wanted to punish.
No, there
you know.
Are various explanations that have been put forward for what
oh,
happened.
Oh, I'd love
there.
To hear yours off the
well,
record.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you on the record, there are a lot of people who think that basically what happened is because Republicans were mostly doing that bill without Democratic input, that and so many of the Democrats are from the places that were affected,
right.
that they didn't have a seat at the table essentially to fight.
Right, but I don't think their intention was to push Democrats out of those states into states that were in play.
Right.
And then
similarly with what happened with Puerto Rico, right? Like there's
right.
this thought that right now that a lot of displaced Puerto Ricans who don't have the recovery there are going to end up in.
True.
Right.
That's true.
Is that going to change politics in Florida?
We'll see.
Yeah. tell me. So your father was born in Cuba. You proud of your Cuban heritage?
Yes.
That issue, and I. When I covered Obama, I was actually on the trip where he went to Cuba.
Right.
Spent a lot of time thinking about how that issue has changed. Spent some time in South Florida talking to people about it. Do you think that we should have an open relationship with Cuba? Do you think that Obama's approach was right? Do you think that Trump's reversal of that approach is the right way to do it?
Yeah, I don't. I don't think Obama's approach was the right approach because I think he did not seem to get the concessions that were part of Helms-Burton that were needed or that were sort of articulated by Congress as a means of opening relations with a country that systematically represses its citizens, that is to this day still arresting political prisoners, still doesn't, you know, respect the right of free press, still doesn't totally respect the right of free religion. So I just don't, I mean, you know, people criticize the embargo because they say that it didn't really effectuate change. Well, neither has anything else. Neither have this opening
Well, the
up.
Obama argument was, and make what you will of it, is right. It didn't work for 50 years, so let's try something different.
Right, right? And that and hasn't then, worked
Well, I
since,
mean, and, right. and, you know, there was like about a year that it had to, before Trump reversed it. So I think they might argue, Obama might argue, like he didn't give it a chance to actually do it.
Well, I mean, right? what you had was a regime change right around the same amount of time. And
yeah, just in the last couple months, right?
Which
was, Castro,
right? Right, which was basically a maintenance of the status quo. Yep. So I don't think that
Yeah, regime change is not, it's just like the Castro is not quite being as much in charge as they were.
Right, right, right. And I think it's a maintenance of the status quo. And so look, I think, you know, it's very difficult because the implications are not just for Cuba. I think there's implications broadly for the hemisphere and for the region, like Venezuela and certainly Nicaragua, where you see Cuba's influence as a promoter of communism and repressive dictatorships expand hemispherically. Mm-hmm. So I think from a geopolitical perspective, you know, the United States has to really figure out how they're going to deal with that issue in a way that protects people in those countries from being violently, treated with, you know, just utter disregard and violence, and you know, Venezuela being a country that's starving now, literally starving.
The numbers that I've seen, and I'm talking to people about this, is that there was always, it seems like there's a generational change on, by and large, where people are in Cuba. Older Cuban Americans are very opposed to the opening, and younger ones are. You are not with your fellow younger Cubans.
I would agree with that, a general statement, and I would caveat it a little bit. And the caveat is based on personal experiences oftentimes. You know, my grandfather was a political prisoner. My uncle was, my great uncle, my grandfather's brother was a political prisoner. My aunt was shot by a militiaman in Cuba. Mm-hmm. So I think the trauma for my family is extremely acute. I think as an elected official that represents citizens in the city of Miami, part of my ideology is shaped by their feelings. Mm-hmm. And I think there's still a huge trauma from citizens that feel that they were kicked out of their country, that, they had to start in a country which was very embracing and amazing in its generosity, but really impacted their lives in a very serious and profound way. Many people succeeded, you know, beyond those obstacles, and their kids certainly most likely succeeded. But you know, my view of I have a very different take on it, which is I think the best way for us to criticize the Castro system is to create the best Miami possible. I think for me, the best Miami possible is the biggest indictment. Having a fluid democracy where we respect freedom of religion, freedom of the press, where we try to create an equitable society, an economically equitable society, which is difficult to do. I think, we're a city that's safe and that's the envy of the world. Mm-hmm. That's the best way for us. And that's what I focused on in my life, rather than, you know, worrying about other governments that I don't control.
Let me ask you just a couple more. I know we're running short on time. You mentioned one of the candidates for governor. How do you feel about the governor's race in Florida this year?
I think there's a lot of good candidates on both sides, honestly. I think the good news for Florida is that there are a lot of good candidates.
Do you want to see a Republican win that or a Democrat win that?
I want to see the best person for Florida win it. I have relationships on both sides. Very close to Mayor Levine from Miami Beach, who's a neighboring
mayor
and a friend. Have gotten to know Adam Putnam. Mm-hmm. I do know. I don't know Gwen very well. Mm-hmm. I just
Gwen
met.
Graham.
Yeah, Gwen Graham. I just met Mayor Gillum. Mm-hmm. Seems like a great guy. You know, has a very eloquent, well spoken. And DeSantis is someone that I've met and spoken to on multiple occasions. I think that it's a strong field, and whomever emerges is going to do well. I think there was a new entrance into the Democratic side.
Everything's getting complicated.
Yeah,
this is an easier
self-funding.
One.
Self-funding. I'll tell you this. I'll back up and say this. You know, I have a concern about where this country is going. Mm-hmm. Related to And I don't mean this as a criticism as an individual. I mean this as a criticism of our system. The self-funding of political campaigns, mm-hmm. where people are putting in 10, 15, 20, 100, mm-hmm. you know, depending on the race, it's a big concern for me.
Yeah,
you
it know, changes because, the way that things go.
I mean, it creates an oligarchy in effect in our country, because let's face it, if you can spend an unlimited amount of money to get elected, you know, it's not a particularly level playing field. And, you know, there are campaign limits on things, but there's no limit on self-financing. That's the only thing. I mean, there's no limits on PACs either, but at least those are derivative of other people. Yeah. And they're also disclosed.
Yeah.
But
some of them.
Right. It's true. True. But I think by and large, I mean, even people that are, you know, big campaign donors, they have limits on what they're going to give. $1 million is a huge, you know, political donation. $10 million is enormous. But no one's going to fund an entire campaign for somebody, $50, $60, $70 million.
It's a lot harder to do. Yeah.
So it's a big concern. It's something that I think we're going to have to look at going forward.
So the governor's race has got a lot of candidates on the Republican side and the Democratic side. The Senate race has just one of each, really. So Bill Nelson, Rick Scott, who do you want to see in the Senate? Shaking your head?
Yeah. I want to see one of them get elected.
But why not? Why is that? One has been a senator for a long time. One's been governor for the last 8 years.
And they've both done a great job.
That's so, how you stay nonpartisan?
Is no, it? I mean, I get along with both of them. You know, I mean, I work with the governor, you know, continually.
I mean, you know them both well. You know how they work.
I do.
And they so both you work must well. You must think that one would be better to be in the Senate.
Why must I? There you go again, trying to pigeonhole, categorize. And I think that's part. Look, I think as a voter, you have to make an ultimate decision without a doubt. I mean, certainly you can't just live in a sort of a Pollyanna world where decisions don't have to be made. But I also fight back sometimes, and maybe it's because I was the mayor's son, you know, going back to that psychology, you know, you fight back a little bit of that, you know, you have to do this and you have to be into this category. You have to support this. And that's a political I don't know, that's sort of the conventional wisdom that I don't necessarily feel like I have to be a part of every time that somebody else does.
Did you vote for President Trump?
I did not.
Who'd you vote for?
I did not vote for President Trump.
Did you vote for Hillary Clinton?
I did not.
Okay. Do you think that President Trump has made it more likely that he'd have your vote if he runs for re-election in 2020?
That's a long time away.
I mean, that seems to be the place where a lot of Latino Republicans are, to bring it back, right?
To bring what
back? To bring it back to the discussion that we were having about...
Yeah,
I mean, that's a danger, right, for the Republican Party overall.
Look, I supported Marco Rubio for president. I thought Marco was is dynamic. I thought he, you know, as a minority, someone who comes from an immigrant family, I thought it would have been amazing for the country to have, you know, a Cuban, Cuban American president.
Yeah.
He's a son of our community. Mm-hmm. Was the first.
You know him? I know him personally. Right?
Absolutely. He was the first Cuban American Speaker of the State House, Florida House. So that was a watershed moment for the state and for Cuban Americans generally. So, you know, that's the kind of mold of person that I supported. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's not even getting into the substance or public policy issues. Really, that's more of the sort of style of somebody who I thought had a very good grasp on foreign policy. I thought he was a compassionate person, really talked about vocational training as a means of progressing our economy, an equitable economy.
But it's a very different situation that we have now. The approach is very different. And it seems like, do you think, and we can end on this, do you think I'm right to say that the Republican Party has a problem in figuring out how to attract Latinos and keep Latinos?
I would say so. I don't think you're wrong in saying that. I think both the Democrat and the Republican Party have challenges in attracting certain demographics. And I think...
But on the immigration stuff, on the way that the approach from President Trump to people of color, does that have lasting impact, do you think?
I don't think right now the Republican Party is attracting Latinos or African Americans in droves.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it that way.
That's a very like sarcastic way of putting it.
No, it's not sarcastic. I think it's literal. I mean, I think it's, you know,
I know in droves or like
even in drips. I think you know, and again, I think, you know, part of it is we've got, you know, if the Republican Party has to decide to create a platform and coherently disseminate it that talks and speaks to the issues of those demographics. And until they do that, just like any other, I mean, I don't think I'm saying anything that's earth-shattering.
No.
You know, unless your politics speak to the people who you want to support you, they're not going to support you.
Yeah. All right. Mayor Francis Suarez, great. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
Suarez told me after we turned off the microphones that no one had asked him before for his thoughts about those questions on Latino leadership and the future of Latinos in the Republican and Democratic parties. Well, what did you think of his answers? Email me at isaac@politico.com and let me know. Thanks as always to Zach Stanton for producing. Remember to subscribe and spread the word. And of course, follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover so you don't miss anything about upcoming episodes or other articles I'm working on. And catch you next time on Off Message.